Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Okay, let's look at KLDAP. That's up first. KLDAP is the, as you could probably guess, it's the header files and the library files, probably, that are required or that help developers access LDAP information through the KDE framework. If you don't know what LDAP is, that doesn't mean anything to you. So LDAP is the lightweight directory something protocol. I don't actually remember what's it stand for. LDAP, LDAP RFC 4510 says that it is the lightweight directory access protocol. I knew that. Lightweight directory access protocol, and that is defined in the in RFC 4510. So ietf.org/RFC/RFC4510.html takes you right there. You can read up all about LDAP. It's quite the read, though, so have fun with that. A little bit more realistically, let me just describe what a directory is. That seems simple enough, right? Well, kind of. So directories, we often, you know, if you're into Linux, I guess, you may find yourself conflating the concept of a directory and a folder. And that's a reasonable thing to do, because a lot of times on Linux, people call folders a directory. I don't know why, I don't remember when my head crossed over between folder and directory and started making those the same things. I'm pretty sure at one point in my life, I just thought of them as folders. I don't think I would have been sort of brought up thinking of them as a directory. Maybe I did, I don't know. But the weird thing is, you'd think that if I didn't know the term directory for folders, I would remember the moment when I realized, oh, a folder and a directory are the same thing in this context. Well, in LDAP, they are not really the same thing, except they are insofar as folders on computers don't exist, right? That's a really important concept to internalize. And it's difficult because it just makes sense. It makes a lot of sense to think of these directories, these folders, as little containers where you put your files. But that's just not how, computers organize data, at least not today, not yet, not in reality. That doesn't make sense for the way computers allocate memory and storage space. And so what ends up happening is that files get allocated to a specific spot on a hard drive, and then you sort of like, you tag them as, oh yeah, by the way, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you're in this folder. So in that sense, if we think of a folder as a list of things that are in it, then that is a directory. Because a directory, as I've been trying to get to for way too long now, is essentially an index, or you might even think of it as a low write, like you do not write to it often, and an often read, a rarely written to but often read index or database, because it contains a bunch of information that contains a bunch of information. And so that's what a directory is. So if you think of like a phone directory, you might have one in your town, in your city, you might have a phone directory. You might not. They do tend to exist still. At least in like the form of Yellow Pages, if nothing else, which is a directory of phone numbers to places that exist in your town. So that's a directory. So lightweight directory access protocol is a lightweight specification for how you might access common information over a network. And LDAP uses just this good old standard TCP/IP protocol. So it doesn't need a whole bunch of layers underneath it. It's designed to be highly efficient, such that when you are, for instance, typing in a email address at your workplace. One of the, ideally, the first place that your email client searches for an auto-completion is LDAP. That way you have access, instant access, near instant access to all the contact information registered in the directory of your workplace. And that directory, again, that's LDAP. Configuring LDAP is not for the faint-hearted. I mean, it's a big job. There's a lot of infrastructure around it. So I don't know if I would personally consider the sort of the experience of LDAP, of configuring LDAP and making it function, is necessarily lightweight, personally. There's a lot of setup there. But once you get it configured and running on your network, your clients ideally have access to it over that network. And more importantly, your client computers, the users of your client computers, they don't have to think about whether they're, they don't have to think, oh, I'm going to go and look something up in the directory. That just appears in their software, in their applications. And that's the slot that KLDAP fills. Because with KLDAP, when you open up Kmail and start typing in an email, you're not thinking, oh, I need to look up my coworker's email address. It's just right there. How did it get there? How does Kmail know that this person whom I've never emailed before at this company exists? Well, the way that Kmail knows is because someone used KLDAP to enable Kmail to search through the directory, through the LDAP instance of that network, for the information. Now, sure, there's other search paths as well. Like Kmail may search through your contacts, or it may search through just sort of your frequently emailed, recent contact, recent list. So that there are those. That's not LDAP, but there is the LDAP component potentially. If the place that you are working uses LDAP, then, and I keep saying working and so on, because usually LDAP is really more of a company, a corporate thing. I don't think typically set up LDAP at home. You would need a lot of people in that home, I think, to justify that kind of investment. But again, investment, I mean, setting it up and configuring it and maintaining it and so on. So I think typically it's at a workplace, and typically it is ideally pretty invisible. It doesn't just have to be email addresses. That's just the most obvious thing that I can think of. But there are other uses for it. One of the places I worked used LDAP to, I believe, describe the location of the office of the person that you were looking, or the desk, sorry, the physical location of the desk, because they were in big sort of open spaces. But it would map out like where the person was situated within that office. It was really cool. I mean, sorry, LDAP didn't do that. They used information from LDAP combined with other information and generator scripts to map that out. It was very cool. Okay, let's talk about Cleopatra. Now, Cleopatra is a little bit tricky in a way, because there's Cleopatra, there's KGPG, and then there's KWallet, and they're all kind of within this they're neighbors, let's say. I don't want to say they're the same thing by any means, because they're not, but I think it'll be most efficient to just talk about them individually. So I'm that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to talk about just Cleopatra, because that's what's on the table right now. So Cleopatra is more or less a front end to OpenPGP, GNUPG, and a little bit of certificate authority stuff. So that's a big sort of big net to cast, but it does it pretty darn well. Generally, Cleopatra gets populated when you confirm a digital signature, or rather a digital a certificate, a key, a public key from an email, an incoming email. So if you get an email from someone and they've signed the email maybe, and they've included their GPG key or their OpenPGP key, PGP key, then if you accept that key, then it gets sort of imported into Cleopatra, or where it gets acknowledged by Cleopatra. Let's put it that way. Cleopatra includes within its domain, and it specifically calls its little domain a key box. And a key box is somewhat akin to a key chain in OpenGPG or OpenPGP. A key chain is it's a digital construct. It is a little database that contains your private key, your public key, and then the public keys of other people who you want to correspond with. And you can create that keychain yourself. Usually you do that with the GNU PG command, GPG2. That's the command name, GPG2. You usually create your keychain with that. And generally you don't even create it yourself. You just create a key for yourself, a private and public key pair. You do that, and then suddenly you have a personal keychain on your system. You can export that keychain and save it, put it onto a thumb drive, lock the thumb drive in a safe. You've got your identity, your digital sort of identity has now been sort of created and not confirmed, but it's been created. The claim of identity that you are making has been digitized in the fact that you've made yourself a key, a private key and a public key pair. Because the public key you can send to other people, and when you encrypt something with your private key, they are able to use your public key to unlock your private key, your private key encrypted message. That's how that works. It's a brilliant system, so brilliant that the person who invented it almost went to jail for it, like literally. So that's GPG, right? That's GPG2. You can create little keys, and when you do that, your system also acknowledges that you're going to need a keychain to keep other people's public keys organized. And so when you start getting emails from people who are off also using PGP or GPG, then they may have either attached their public key, or you have searched a key server for a copy of their public key. These are public key. They're called public keys for a reason. They are meant to be public. So you could search a key server for the public key, and then you can get a copy of it. And when you do that, when you import the public key, it gets imported into your keychain. Okay, so now that's been defined, forget about it, because that's not what Cleopatra uses. Cleopatra technically uses something of its own called, that it calls, apparently, a key box. And I never knew that. You'll never know that. It's not something that it makes known, really. It's just if you read the handbook, which I did in preparation for this episode, and I'm glad I did, because I mean, honestly, I've used Cleopatra. I use it, fairly regularly. So I was just going to say, oh, this is a thing that that manages your OpenGPG or your GNU PG keychain. Like, that's what it always has sort of felt like to me. But technically speaking, it's doing more than that. And I guess I kind of knew that, because here I'm looking at things that are completely normal to me. Hey, there's Aaron, there's Adrian, there's Alan, there's Brian, there's Brenton, there's Dave, there's David, all these names that I'm like, yeah, I know those people. Those are all people whose keys I have. And then there's CA cert signing authority, DOD, root CA3. These aren't people. These aren't even public keys. These are literal certificates. These are SSL certs and things like that. And well, that's kind of the added bonus that you get with Cleopatra. And in fact, in the introduction of the handbook, it says Cleopatra is the KDE tool for managing X.509 and OpenPGP certificates in the GPGSM and GPG key boxes, and for retrieving certificates from LDAP and other certificate servers. Cleopatra can be started from KMail's Tools Certificate Manager menu, as well as from the terminal, as well as just from the executable, the application itself. From the K menu, or however you start your applications on your computer. I'll assume the K menu. Okay, so Cleopatra, it opens up. There's a big window at the bottom, or there's a big panel at the bottom of the window that lists all of the keys that you have in your key box, which includes your OpenGPG keychain and other certificates, other locally stored certificates that you have purview over. So it's not going to have stuff from your /etc directory. It's just going to have the stuff that you've got locally within your user, in your home directory. The nice thing about Cleopatra, well, there's so many nice things about Cleopatra. I don't even know where to begin, to be honest, but I guess I have to start somewhere. So how about if I start with, what if you don't have a keychain? Let's just say you don't have that yet. You haven't taken that step. Well, you could do it from the terminal, and you could do like GPG to --help. And then read the little help menu. This is a very reasonable application. I like the GPG2 interface a lot more than I like the other GPG, just GPG, that command. GPG2 is nice, but Cleopatra arguably is even nicer. It helps you with prompts and menus and selections and buttons and things like that. It's the add user to the user add command, except not a command at all. It's a graphical application. So let's say that you want to create a new key pair for yourself, and this is going to create both a keychain and, I guess, a key box. So when you first launch Cleopatra, if there's nothing else in it, it just kind of gives you a greeting screen. Welcome to Cleopatra. And then there's two buttons, new key pair or import. Both of these are really, really useful because maybe you already have a keychain and you just need to import it into Cleopatra. Well, there's a way to do that, obviously. It makes it very, very simple. But generally speaking, in this case, let's assume that you need to create a new key pair. You could click that button there, or you could go to File, New Key Pair. And then you get to the same place, which is choose what kind of key pair you want to create. And it gives you a choice between OpenPGP to create a personal OpenPGP key pair, or X.509, which is certified by some kind of certificate authority. It needs to be sent to a certificate authority to actually finish being created. I'm going to assume you don't have that level of authentication in your personal life. You might at your job, you might at work have that, but for just personal comms, I'm going to assume OpenPGP is the way that you want to go. So create a personal key. I'm going to call it Klaatu. Email address. This is kind of important because, I mean, this is the email address at which, or that's going to sort of be associated with this key. So, I mean, it can be any email address, but when people are searching for your public key, that's probably one of the ways they're going to identify you by. But this key is not sort of bound to one email address. You can email and use any email address. As long as you have your private key, people are supposed to be able to safely assume that email truly does come from you. So the email address is important for findability, but you're not wedding the two together. You're not binding them inextricably. You can always add more email addresses to a key. If you want to help people find that key, you can remove email addresses and so on. Okay, so I'm just going to put Klaatu at example.com. And then it asks you whether you want to protect the generated key with a passphrase. And that's up to you, I guess. Generally, I think probably it's a good idea to protect it with a passphrase. That's kind of what I feel like. The passphrase is not recoverable. You cannot, it's going to be encoded into your key, and that's going to be the passphrase for that key. I haven't done a whole lot of reading to find out sort of whether, what the prevailing thoughts are on the usefulness of that password, honestly. But I feel a little bit better about protecting it with a password myself, because that way, I don't know, there's just that one more layer between someone clicking send on a message bearing my OpenPGP signature or certificate or encryption, and making sure that that's actually me clicking send. There's also a button to see the technical details, which lets you choose the the specification of the key that you're going to create. So the prevailing key at the time of this recording seems to be ED25519. Kind of seems to be the latest algorithm, but if you know better or you have a preference, then you're able to choose that from the technical details menu or the setup screen, whatever. Okay, so I'm going to click OK on that, and now it's asking me to create a passphrase. Bogus 123, bogus 123. This is obviously being done on a virtual machine. I'm not actually setting anything up that I want to keep here. A new OpenPGP certificate was created successfully. Find some suggested next steps. The fingerprint is here. Great. Make a backup of your key pair. Send public key by email. Upload to a public directory service. Okay, so that's it. Now I have a key box and a key chain. And in Cleopatra, I see that I've now got one entry in my little key box here. And it tells you some information about it. It says that it is valid from 2022 to 2024. Here's the key ID. Here's the name associated with it and the email associated with it and so on. So that's kind of useful, but that's about as useful as an empty key box is going to get. So I'm going to now transfer over. I'm going to close this little virtual machine here and go back up to my real machine so that I can talk about what you can do once you have a key box, an active key box. So the first, and I guess I think personally the most useful one is the filter field. You can, you know, if you're looking for someone's key for some reason, I mean, I honestly don't know why you would be, but you can look, you can filter out things and just look at their keys. So for instance, here's someone's key. I've just filtered it out by name. So Aaron, there's Aaron's key. It's not certified. It's valid from 2002 and it's valid until forever. So as far as I know, this hasn't been, you know, this hasn't expired. This hasn't been revoked. So it's probably still a valid key. What I'm going to do with that, I don't know. I guess I mean, one thing you can do with it is double click on it to get more information about it. So double click on that key, and then you get a lot of like I said, you can add email addresses to a key. And indeed, for this particular key, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different email addresses associated with this key. So if I get an email from one of these domains and I think, why is this person emailing me from that address, from example.com? Well, you could go here, look at the key and observe that, oh, well, yeah, this does seem to be an acknowledged email address from this person. And then you get certificate details about when it expires, what kind of key it is, the fingerprint, and so on. The capabilities of the key, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, you can do that. You could also sign keys, which is really nice. So when you or certify a key, you're telling your internal, your keychain, you're telling your keychain that you trust or do not trust or moderately trust or ultimately trust this key. Now, you're really only supposed to do that when you're face to face with someone and that when they can demonstrate to you that they have control and ownership over the private key, then you mark their the public key that again they can demonstrate they have ownership over, then you're supposed to be able to mark it as, you know, trusted or ultimately trusted or whatever you feel comfortable with. I mean, that's a sort of a level of trust. You know, what ultimate trust is versus normal trust, I don't know. Like that's up to you. But most people assign it to sort of like you're in person, you see there some kind of officially issued identification, like an ID card, a government ID card, whatever, and then they are able to demonstrate that, or they don't have to demonstrate, but they are vouching with their identification for a key with the fingerprint of whatever. If that's enough for you, then you can mark it trusted or ultimately trusted or whatever you feel comfortable with. Okay. So some keys in my list here, and again, this list is populated by KMail for me because I open something up in KMail. It tells me, hey, this is encrypted, or this is signed. And then I choose what I want to do from there. I can either accept it, import the key, you know, decrypt, or maybe I don't have the key, so I have to go find the key from the key database and then import it, whatever. I get to choose how I deal with what I get in an email. And once I accept it and tell Kmail that yes, that's a private key that I want to keep track of, it adds it to my keychain. And then Cleopatra also picks it up from there. So there are some that have expired, officially expired. Like someone has set an expiry date on their key, and between the time that it was valid, I picked it up. But since then, it has expired. So I can select the expired ones, or I can use the filter box. And there's a little drop-down menu next to the filter box. I can select just the expired one. So now I've got a bunch of colored red, keys here in my list, and I can right click on one of them and choose delete. It confirms that I really want to delete that, and there it's gone. And I can keep doing that probably, honestly, indiscriminately. Like, I can't think of a good reason to keep an expired key, really. So I'm just gonna actually delete all of them right now. There, done. Thank you, dear listener, for inspiring me to keep my OpenGPG keychain a little bit tidier. There's other stuff too. You can do things like you can sign or encrypt a file that you want to send to a person in this list by selecting their public key. Oh, here's a revoked one. I could delete that as well. You can select their key and then click sign encrypt. And then it asks you to select one or more files to sign and or encrypt. So you can select a file, and then it encrypts that file such that the person who owns the other pair of this public key will be able to decrypt it. You can also use their key to decrypt something. So if they've sent you a file that has been encrypted by them and you want to decrypt it, you can use their public key from here to decrypt it. Now, in Kmail, that all happens invisibly. Or not invisibly. Kmail, at least the way I have it set, it prompts me. It alerts me, hey, this has been encrypted. Would you like to decrypt it? I say yes, and then it decrypts it. So I don't generally use Cleopatra for that, but I could if I needed to. Like if someone had sent me a file that maybe I keep on my hard drive encrypted generally, but then I decide, well, I want to look at that one file today, so let me decrypt it now. So maybe I would go here, select the name, say decrypt, find the file that has been encrypted, and let it decrypt, maybe to my RAM disk or something. I can also import certificates. I can export a certificate, like a public key. I can what they call certify, which is what I was just saying. You mark it trusted or untrusted. You could look up a new key on a server. So that's quite handy as well. And you even have a really cool little encrypted notebook. Like you have a little notepad here that you can enter notes into and encrypt stuff or decrypt stuff with either your key or the keys to whom you want that note to go to and so on. It's a very, very cool application. And it's one of those that I feel like once you start using GPG or OpenPGP or whatever, I feel like Cleopatra becomes, well, really just a saving grace, honestly, because the GPG terminal command, just honestly, it's not that it's not good, it's that you don't use it often enough to get good at it. Now, that might be different for you for whatever reason. Maybe you're always using the GPG2 command or some set of GPG tooling. For me, though, it's really something I use very, very infrequently. And so, you know, like most of my interactions with GPG are either for my own locally encrypted files or for emailed files that people send to me that I then decrypt with Kmail practically invisibly. And then I don't think about, you know, I don't really have to interact that much with GPG directly. And so when I have to use the GPG2 command, it is always slow going for me because I just never use it directly. I have a whole directory structure of encrypted files because I use the pass command, which is a little command. It's called password store, and it is a command to to save passwords for your browser, whether it's Firefox or Chromium or Chrome or whatever you use. There's probably a plugin for it called Password Store, and you can just use locally encrypted GPG files to store your passwords, your username and your password. So it's really a useful thing. But again, that's not something that I actually interact with directly. I use it through a browser, which calls the OpenPGP, OpenGPG, GNU PG, whatever it's called, stuff in the background. And so I'm not actually doing that. So local files, I have like probably literally hundreds of locally encrypted GPG stuff, but I don't interact with it directly. I've got Cleopatra that I can use to look at my keychain so I don't have to fiddle with GPG2. It is a really, really nice application. And I think that it single-handedly makes GNUPG, OpenPGP, I think it makes it so much more approachable. Honest. That's my feeling. So if you have been resisting the pull towards encrypted communications, check out Cleopatra. Honest, you should check it out. It is easy to get started. You just create one new key pair for yourself, and then you've got everything you need. You've got your key pair, you've got your keychain, and KMail makes it really easy to encrypt or just digitally sign stuff. The difference there being digitally signed just says, yes, this is sent from this person. Look, here's a copy of their key information, whereas encrypting jumbles all the information and it cannot be unjumbled unless that person has a copy of your public key. How do they get your public key? Well, you follow Cleopatra's advice and you upload your key, your public key, to a key server, and Cleopatra can help you with that as well. So it is the application, honestly. It is the application that makes GPG really usable. And it's not that complex. Like, I'm not saying it makes anything perfect. I don't mean that, because I'm not convinced that any of this is as simple as it needs to be. And I believe that if it was as simple as it needed to be, then it would be widely adopted, because it would just be a thing that we all did. We wouldn't even have to think about it. So there's still something, there's a gap that needs to be bridged. I don't think Cleopatra is the bridge. I don't think OpenGPG is the bridge. I don't think, what was it, Keybase? I don't think that was the bridge. There's still some component missing here because we're not all using it right now. But if you want to start using it, start with Cleopatra. That's my advice to you. It's a great application, if I haven't made that clear. Cleopatra, very cool. Try it out. Let's go get coffee. As I sit here sipping my fresh cup of coffee, I have to admit I've been playing Clickety. Now, that's conveniently the next application on the list, so it's convenient that I am playing it. But before I talk about it, I want to mention a book by a former listener. So this very nice individual, V Subhash, has emailed me and told me that they used to listen to my podcast, kind of fell off for a while, which is fine, by the way. I think podcasts are a little bit like, well, honestly, like people, at least people, I think this is how people view the world. I think there's an aspect to relationships where you meet someone, they're perfect in your life at a certain time, and then you kind of drift apart because of reasons. You have different jobs, you go in different directions, physical directions, whatever. That's just, you know, you come together for a little while, and then you part ways, and it's nice. That's how podcasts are sometimes. You know, you start listening to something, it's like your best companion on the way to work every day, and then you get a different job, different route to work, different habits, and you never think about that podcast again. I think there's beauty to that. So it's okay that V. Subhash has stopped listening to my podcast. That's perfectly fine. Nevertheless, though, interestingly, V. Subhash thought to email me when they recently published a book called FFmpeg Quick Hacks on A-Press. No, I'm sorry. It's called Quick Start Guide to FFmpeg on A-Press. It is a rewritten version of a book that I think V. Subhash had self-published, FFmpeg Quick Hacks. So it's called, on A-Press, it's called Quick Start Guide to FFmpeg. So hunt that book down, because it's got a lot of cool information in it about FFmpeg, like verifiably cool. And you know, FFmpeg can be tricky. It really can be. I mean, you can do amazing things with it, but sometimes those command, I mean, a command can sometimes feel and almost act like a whole script. And it's just one command. So it can be tricky. And I think the more that you, I mean, certainly if you're curious about using FFmpeg, I think the more sort of quick hacks or getting started guides that you read, the better. Because there's just so much in it, and you really kind of have to learn. I don't even know if it's about learning half the time. Sometimes it's just show me how to do the thing. And this book is loaded with cool tricks. So check that out. It's on A-Press. It is called Quick Start Guide to FFmpeg by V. Subhash. And I'm sorry, V. Subhash, if you do listen now, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. But that was a really cool moment to hear back from a listener who'd gone away, but and nevertheless thought to contact me later to say sort of like thank you. In fact, V. Suhash says, I should also say that I was inspired by you in this context being Klaatu, you to change fully to Linux and to try to do everything with open source. I write, illustrate, design, format, and build all my books, PDF and ebook, using only free and open source software. So that's really, really cool. Okay, so let's see, what's Clickety all about? Clickety is like that other game. I don't remember what the game was called, but it was I've covered it already. It was like K Bejeweled or something like that, or K Crystal Orbs or something like that. It was some game where you click rows of colored dots and they disappear. So it's kind of like Tetris in reverse. And this is similar to that, but there's something different to it. And the goal of Clickety is that you want to reduce your board, your playing board, to, I guess, nothing. And you do that by clicking sort of conglomerates of similarly colored regions. And the thing is, the trick about it is that regions can merge when you click away something else. So, for instance, let's say I've got a region, a yellow region and a yellow region, but they're separated by a couple of blobs of green. Well, now if I click that green region, it disappears, and all the stuff on top of it falls down a level, thereby causing the two yellow regions that was formerly separated by the green to merge. So now I can click this new single yellow region and get rid of that. Well, now that's caused a blue region that was formerly two separate regions to merge. I could click that blue region, but there's some blue below it still. So I could maybe instead merge those, merge that, and then maybe merge that even more, and then click the blue region away. Or maybe that wasn't the right move. Maybe I should have ignored the blue region and clicked something else to merge something greater. You cannot click single sort of blobs, like a single block. You cannot click that. It has to be, I think, two or greater. And again, the more you merge together, the better chance you have of getting rid of more sort of floor space in your little playing board. It's trickier than it seems, but it's also it's got that sort of mobile game feel to it. So it's not what I would think of as like a super stressful game. It's one of those where you just get to click and idly sort of click things away and change the board a little bit, and then at some point you run out of things to remove. At some point you've taken away everything that you can, you get scored, and that game is over. And that time I did pretty good. I only had 13 pieces left apparently out of 160. Now I'm playing on easy mode. There are several different modes that you can play on, from very easy to medium to hard to custom. Custom being whatever you want it to be, as defined in the Configure Clickety menu. So if you go to, what is it, Settings, Configure Clickety, then under Custom Game, you can define what the width of your game board is, the height of your game board, and the color count, the different kinds of color that you have. There's also, of course, different themes. Kind of disappointingly, there's not an Egyptian theme. It's too bad. And there are sounds and keyboard shortcuts. And anything else? No, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's a really simple game. It's like it's a mobile game, essentially, except it's on your computer and you just click. You click, you click, you click. And I think there's an addicting quality to that, you know? That's just kind of weirdly soothing sometimes to just you're just removing colored pieces from this board and you're just seeing how much you can get rid of. And of course, the game keeps the state of the board keeps changing. So, you know, you kind of feel like you're leveling up sometimes just because you've collapsed some things together that weren't contiguous before. I think there's a game design lesson to be learned there too, you know, like that amount of board state change is really, really satisfying. Whereas in the game from last time, which was called K Jumping Cube, where you had these dice, an array of dice, and you kept flipping the dice over, and the more you flipped a dice, the more, you know, it sort of like spread points around it. But the thing that I was noticing on that game was that it was kind of disheartening when you thought, okay, 80% of the board belongs to my opponent, I've lost, let's just get this over with so we can start a new game. But instead, it keeps drawing it out because then you regain another 20%, and then they regain 40%, you know, and it just keeps going back and forth and back and forth. And it gets, I guess, if he'd regained 40 points, that would, or 40%, that would have been because 80 minus 20, then 60 plus 40. Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, point is, that was not satisfying to me anyway. Whereas this one, where it's the board keeps changing, sometimes in a satisfying way, sometimes, oh, I could have optimized that differently or whatever, but it keeps you really kind of intrigued and kind of wanting more, which is, it's just an interesting difference between that. Maybe, I mean, part of the thing might be that there is no opponent here. It's a game that you're just playing against the clock, against the gravity of the cubes. That's it. Whereas with K Jumping Cube, you're fighting for victory. So maybe there's a difference there. But I like Clickety a lot. That is a game that I could have seen. I could see like something like that for like an open, like a game jam or something like that. I feel like that's an attainable kind of game. And they're great, you know, 'cause like that's the, like I keep saying, that's a mobile game to me. That's what I think of when I think of a mobile game. A classic mobile game is just that, you know, you got your phone just kind of in one hand and you're on the bus or whatever, and you're just clicking the screen, whiling away the time. Is it as productive as, I don't know, like a crossword or Sudoku or something like that? Probably not, but it certainly does satisfy the passage of time. And in certain situations, that's just what you want, something really simple, but kind of tactile in a way and satisfying. So Clickety, check it out. It's fun. Speaking of mobile games and of games that I could see trying to re-implement or implement in a game jam, the next one in the list is called K Lines, or as it calls itself, Color Lines. I was not able to find a handbook for this. I went to help. I went to Color Lines Handbook. Nothing came up. So I looked it up online, and luckily there are instructions online on how this game is supposed to work. It is a really, really fun game. I didn't like it at first at all because I couldn't figure it out. But once I researched a little bit, I realized what I was doing wrong and discovered that it's a really, really fun game. So by default, the Egyptian theme came up, and I love the Egyptian theme normally, but for this particular game, I found gems or crystal or metal to be much, much more useful. I thought the gems was perfectly fine. So it's a picture of a chessboard, and at the beginning, at the start of the game, you have maybe two gems on it. And you're supposed to move those gems in some position. Oh, three gems I have. So I've got two green gems and a purple gem. Well, I can't do anything with a single gem, so I'm gonna take the green and line it up with the other green one. Now, unfortunately, once you take a move, once you move a gem, and you can move it as far as you want across the board, it doesn't matter how many spaces. And that's a very satisfying feeling. Unfortunately, after you take an action, more gems are placed onto your board, apparently at random. I can't find the pattern. I think it's just randomly. So now you've got more gems on your board. All right, no problem. I can try to organize those a little bit. So I've got two yellow gems that have just appeared, so I'll put those next to each other. And then, of course, more gems get dumped onto my board. So I've got another yellow gem, so I can just line that up with my yellow gems. I've got a green gem, but the green gems that I had put together are no longer accessible. The top and the bottom of that row has been blocked off by a blue gem and a red gem that I can't really do a whole lot with. Well, actually, the blue gem, I could move over here. So in other words, I'm moving these gemstones around this board pretty much sort of like almost arbitrarily. But the goal is to get them into rows of five. And when you achieve a row of five, it disappears. That whole row disappears, freeing up game board space, which is really important, as you'll come to find out, because that game board just keeps filling up no matter what you do. And it's annoying because sometimes a thing that you're working on, that you're building, fills up, and now you can't, you know, you can't make that row disappear or whatever. So yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it gets tricky after a while because your gems can only move through contiguous spaces. So if the computer can find a path from the square that you want to, from the square that your gem is to where you want that gem to be, then you can make that move. But if the computer can't find a valid path from here to there, then you can't get there. You cannot move diagonally. You can move vertically and horizontally, which of course can sort of mimic a diagonal movement. But it's not true diagonal because once, like, if you are blocked off on both sides and you see a clear path just diagonally, you won't be able to get there. Even though you feel like you should be able to get there, you won't be able to because it's a diagonal move. And that board can get so full, and then you'll see something and you'll think, oh, I can clear that row. And suddenly the board isn't quite as full as it was. And boy, is that satisfying. But those gems, they just keep appearing. It's the worst, it's the most pesky thing. They just keep appearing on your board. And eventually you run out of space. And once your board is full, then, or I guess once there are no more, no, yeah, once it's full, then the game over is over. So again, it's kind of like the reverse it's kind of like Tetris, except without any structure to it. Because they just keep getting, the gems keep getting dumped onto your board without really any predictability, which is just the most annoying thing. Because you'll, like I say, you'll be building a row and you'll think you're doing great. And then something will happen and fill up that, you know, and block off that row or something like that. And it's just so disheartening. But yeah, it's a fun little game. And you can really, really, you know, like, you can just almost see the code of the Pathfinder in the game. You know, you can almost see it. You might not know how to write it, but you know it was written. You know that it's clever, and it makes you really just want to rewrite it yourself because it's really well done. So that is Color Lines. Again, probably a really, really great mobile game. Like, it's surely something that is on, it must be on a phone platform already. Definitely that would be a contender for a converged application from KDE. That should definitely be on all the mobile phones. Oh my gosh, I have to stop playing these games. They're really fun. And I think that's evident in the fact that you kind of can't. Oh, there's the handbook. It did pop up, but it was on a different desktop and it didn't bring it to the front. Well, that would have been useful several minutes ago. Finally, last but not least, is KMag. This is an accessibility application, really. And what it does, it's a little bit tricky when you first launch it, because you don't exactly maybe understand what's going on, but it puts a little viewport in the middle of your screen, or at least that's where it appears for me, and it's tracking your mouse cursor, but confusingly, it also shows your mouse cursor in the magnifying window. So it almost looks like it has grabbed hold of your mouse and stuck it to the middle of this window. But actually, that's a copy of your mouse, and your actual mouse is traveling around the screen as usual. But you're seeing the portion of the screen that you're dragging your mouse across in this window at some magnification level. By default, it seems to be sort of doubling it, but you can make it even bigger, 1 to 3, 1 to 4, 1 to 5, 1 to 6, all the way up to 1 to 20. So you can get down to like just a very, very, very precise pixel level, like where you can see the pixels. Like it's very, very, it can be very magnified if you want it to be. And you can make this window quite large. So you could have, for instance, I don't know, you could have like half your screen be magnified and then the other half be not magnified, something like that. Or you could put this on a separate monitor, maybe. You could do that. So this seems really useful to me for a very practical purpose of, well, my vision isn't as good as it needs to be to see, the size of this interface. Let me blow it up in KMag to get a closer look. Or it could be just something for a more just not a I was gonna say a more practical use case, but that is practical. It's very practical to magnify something that you can't see. That's like the epitome of practicality. It's very good. No, but I meant just like f just for because you need a closer look at something, which I guess is actually saying the same thing. You can't see something on your screen for whatever reason. You want to magnify it. KMag is the tool you can use to do that. Now, for me personally, I have that same feature activated in system settings, somewhere in system settings, in I think desktop, yeah, workspace behavior, desktop effects. There is a magnifier fun no, a zoom function, sorry. Zoom function, which allows you to assign a keyboard shortcut to magnifying or demagnifying your screen. And I have it set up to F8 to zoom in and F7 to zoom out. And that works really well for me. The thing is, though, that's zooming in, your whole screen. So then your whole screen becomes the magnification portal, and you can zoom back out with F7. So F8, F7. I mean, that's arbitrary. That's just what I do for myself. And it's actually not for myself. It's because I do screen shares sometimes, and I want people to be able to see a certain detail of an application that I am demo d that I'm demonstrating or training them on. So that's why that's there. So and it always amazes people when I'm able to do that. Like I don't know why that's such a big deal to people, but I'll zoom into something and they won't believe that that's possible. They won't understand how that they assume I'm using some kind of fancy screen capturing software, and I have to always tell them, well, not always, not everyone cares, but when they ask, I tell them, nope, that's just my desktop. It's just something that Linux does for free. It just does that if you turn that feature on. So it's a cool feature. KMag or system settings, make things bigger if you need it bigger. Honestly, if your eyes are straining to see something, do not suffer through it. Just make it bigger. It's so easy on Linux to do, and it's so nice. It is just so nice. It's such a nice feature. Those are the kind of features that make me really optimistic for technology, that kind of feature, that kind of accessibility feature, because it's one of those things where some people absolutely need that. Some people's vision, just if the technology isn't built for their vision, and that is a shame. But if we can activate things like magnification and make it really easy to get to, then that could change the computing experience for people. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it in real life. I know people, several people, who use screen magnification as a matter of course. Like that is the primary way they interface with their computer. And it makes me really, really annoyed actually when that's a feature that gets hidden away, because it's kind of like saying, I mean, it's like, hey, person in a wheelchair, we have a wheelchair ramp right there at the top of the stairs. You just have to get up the stairs to get to the wheelchair. It's like, why are we putting accessibility features, why are we hiding them behind things that people might not be able to access? The accessibility features, to my mind, should be on by default, and then you deactivate them if you have the ability to easily deactivate them. It only makes sense. I mean, I will totally admit that if all the accessibility features were turned on a desktop by default, yes, I can see how that could be problematic. But I wonder if there's an easier entryway into those accessibility features that would be better than, for instance, knowing to go to system settings, going to workspace behavior, going into desktop effects, going to Zoom, and then clicking on the configuration button so that you can figure out what the buttons to Zoom are. And then you've got 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 different options of all the different ways that you could Zoom. I mean, it gets complex. And I just wonder if there's a better way for us to make sure that people who can't see the screen, could they get to that feature? You know, like, how can you turn on the magnifying glass if you can't see the screen? If you can't see the words on the screen that say turn on the magnifying feature? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. So there's, once again, there's a gap that needs to be bridged here. But KMag and zooming in with KWin, those are two great features. I think they're super important. I think they're features that we should be proud of as open source enthusiasts. We should promote them. We should talk about them. They should not be hidden features, and we should have more of that. Accessibility is just so important, especially in open source. Why? Because open source is supposed to be for everybody. That's the ethos. So let's build that into the software. Okay, that's KMag. Congratulations to the developers who developed that. Thank you so much for that feature. Thank you for the KWin features that enable accessibility for everyone. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to this show. I will talk to you next week.